Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. More than 104 million Americans, including 2 million Marylanders, are now fully vaccinated against COVID-19, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But the New York Times recently reported on CDC data showing more than 5 million people who got a first shot of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines missed their second doses. That's about 8%, 1 out of 12 people. The Maryland Health Department says the picture here is much brighter. Just 3.6% of first dose recipients have skipped their second dose appointment. Why is this happening? How much of a problem is drop-off? My guest this morning, Dr. William Moss, is a professor and executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Moss, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Sheila.
What's behind the drop-off?
Yes, there are a number of reasons why people may receive or elect to receive just a single dose. There are some populations in which it's actually difficult. They have trouble accessing vaccines, I'll put it that way. Those are some of the populations for which the single dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine are most advantageous. And this can include, you know, populations like the homeless or incarcerated populations or migrant populations. But what we're talking about here are individuals who accessed the vaccine, who got their first dose, and then are reluctant to get that second dose. And so that's less of an access problem and more of a kind of misunderstandings, I'll say, about the value of the second dose. Now, some people choose not to get the second dose just because it's inconvenient. Others, because they are maybe have fear of getting a vaccination, or maybe they had some side effect of the first vaccine and are very concerned about the side effects of the second vaccine. And there is some protection conferred by a single dose. We know that from the studies, but we know far less about that. And we certainly know that the protection is much higher after a second dose. And, you know, it takes that 2 weeks. So people are considered fully vaccinated after the second, 2 weeks after the second dose of the Pfizer Moderna vaccine. So people are making a trade-off, but it's a very risky trade-off in terms of the duration and magnitude of their protection.
Well, I know you said you're still looking into it, but how risky a trade-off? I mean, what's your sense if I came to you right now as an individual and just asked you, how much protection am I losing by skipping the second dose?
Yes. And so some of the data comes from the phase three trials and looking at, you know, people who got infected before receiving the first and second dose. And some of it comes from our effectiveness studies. And it also, obviously, the time since vaccination is really critical. We know that in the phase three trial for the Pfizer Moderna vaccine, that they were both roughly 95% protective. Had 95% efficacy 2 weeks after that second dose. You're talking about 80% or less, perhaps, after that single dose.
Mm. Second dose appointments are 3 weeks after the first shot for Pfizer and 4 weeks after for Moderna. How much wiggle room do you have in the timing of the second dose?
In the trials, people are given the vaccine, that second dose, at that time period. So again, you know, what we have the most evidence for is sticking with that time schedule. Now, that time schedule was developed in part to help us learn about the efficacy of two doses as soon as possible. So there is wiggle room around those second doses. And Sheila, there's been very vigorous debate here and in other countries about actually deliberately delaying that second dose in order to get more first doses into more people. And so some countries have opted to do that, for example, the United Kingdom or Canada. So there is wiggle room in the timing of that second dose. But again, the evidence, the scientific evidence that we have is really around that 3-week time period for the Pfizer and the 4-week time period for the Moderna, as you said.
Most people who experience side effects from the vaccine have mild reaction, but obviously some side effects like blood clots are serious. How are serious reactions reported and investigated?
Yeah, so there are a number of mechanisms for identifying serious side effects from vaccines. Now, obviously, you know, through the development and evaluation of the vaccines, the phase one, phase two, phase three trials, safety is really paramount. And that's obviously required for the emergency use authorization or for an approval by the Food and Drug Administration. But some side effects are quite rare. And those are identified after a vaccine is put into more widespread use, obviously following an authorization or an approval. There are a number of mechanisms for detecting those. We here in the United States have a very carefully well-designed system. The longest standing one was established by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration, called the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, or VAERS. Now, this is what we call a passive reporting system, where healthcare providers or vaccine recipients can report adverse events that happen after vaccination. But it's very important, Sheila, for people to understand that not all of those, and in fact, probably a small proportion of those adverse events are actually caused by the vaccine. And that's what really requires the rigorous investigation. And this is exactly what we saw with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the blood clots here in the United States. Though there were 6 cases that were reported of these severe and unusual clotting events, those 6 were in younger women, and that's how those were detected. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, at least at that point, that the vaccine is the cause of these clotting disorders, and that's what requires the investigation, and we saw that with the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices.
But if someone has a serious or lasting reaction, should they get the second dose?
Yes, and I'm sure that's on the minds of many people. And so I think of kind of broad types or categories of adverse events that we're seeing right now. The most common are the kind of inflammation, local inflammation at the site of the injection, more systemic inflammation with a headache and muscle aches and fatigue that many people feel, particularly after the second dose of Pfizer-Moderna vaccine. These are 12 to 36, 48 hours. This is why people may need to take a day off of work after they get a vaccine dose, and again, particularly the second dose. Those are transient, and those are not a contraindication to receiving a second dose. Now, we did learn after these vaccines were authorized, and the reports first came out of the United Kingdom, of severe allergic reactions. We use the term anaphylactic reactions. These types of reactions occur very early after vaccination, within 15 to 30 minutes generally, more common in people who've had allergic reactions before. And for our listeners who've gotten vaccinated, hopefully many of them have, this is why people are asked to sit for 15 or 20 minutes and why there are medical personnel at the site of vaccination to treat these severe allergic reactions. Those are a contraindication to a second dose. So if someone has a severe allergic reaction to the vaccine or knows that they have a severe allergic reaction to one of the components of the vaccine, although not many people would know that, those individuals should not get the second dose.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Dr. William Moss, who heads the International Vaccine Access Center at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We're speaking about second doses and other COVID vaccine issues. Once someone is fully vaccinated, how long does that protection last?
Yeah, Sheila, this is still an important outstanding question, and obviously one of the big ones, because it drives the need for additional doses or booster doses. So we obviously don't know how long the immune protection lasts, because we're relatively new into this game. We just started vaccinating individuals kind of in mid-December of 2020. And so we need more evidence. We need to continue to follow vaccinated individuals and see how long that protection lasts. Now, we do have preliminary results from both Pfizer and Moderna about the 6-month protective efficacy of their vaccines. And they're roughly on the order of about 90% that they're seeing out to 6 months. So that is a little bit lower than what we saw when the emergency use authorization were granted. Those data were based on a median or where half of the study participants had 2 months of follow-up. So we're seeing good protective efficacy out to 6 months in the longer-term follow-up of the trial participants, but we're just going to need to continue to monitor this and see how long that protective immunity lasts.
So you think booster shots are a possibility?
They're definitely a possibility. I would be surprised if we need them within the first year, but we will have to see. But there are two main reasons, Sheila, for additional doses or booster doses. One is waning immunity, and the other are the variants. And so those two factors are going to drive the need for additional doses.
So current vaccines may not work very well against the variants?
Well, right now, I think the main message is that our current vaccines work well against all of the variants. Obviously, there's we have a number of different vaccines. There are a number of variants of concern around, and there are some differences. So, for example, the AstraZeneca vaccine has not performed as well against the variant first identified in South Africa, that B1351 variant. And so South Africa opted not to use that vaccine going further. But I would say that the current evidence is that the Pfizer, the Moderna, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, all of which are authorized in the United States, remain highly effective against the dominant variants. And here in the United States, the dominant variant is that B117 variant that was first identified in the United Kingdom. Our current vaccines are highly effective against that variant.
At this stage of the pandemic, what is your greatest concern?
Yes, my greatest concern is, I'll say two things. One is the emergence of variants that can escape the vaccine immunity. And as we were just saying, we haven't seen that yet. There are for some matches between vaccines and particular variants, some reduced efficacy, some reduced protection, but all the vaccines remain highly protective against a severe disease. And that's really what we're most concerned about. But, you know, let's say, you know, given the high level of transmission, let's say in India right now, for example, that just provides an enormous opportunity for viral mutations to occur and for potentially for the virus to evolve away from prior immunity. So that's the nightmare scenario, if you will, if we start seeing transmission of viruses for which prior vaccination or prior infection is no longer protective. My other big concern, Sheila, is around the hesitancy and the misinformation and disinformation around COVID-19 vaccines that really grows out of this mistrust that we've had in this country and has grown around the world in vaccines in general. And if people are reluctant or refuse to get vaccinated, those individuals are going to continue to be susceptible and at risk of infection. And, you know, bringing those two concerns together, as long as there are susceptible people in the world, that allows the virus to be transmitted, but it also allows the virus to mutate.
I appreciate your sharing all this information with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheila.
Dr. William Moss is a professor and executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Short break here. When we're back, is herd immunity within reach? I'm Sheila Gass. Stay with us on The Record on WYPR.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Hi, I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Hala Vinsay.
In the coming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll be sharing five advantages of health savings accounts and also some key findings from a new report on the rapidly evolving workplace. You can find the Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life podcast on WYPR's website and mobile app, wherever you get your podcasts, and at transamericainstitute.org.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. COVID-19 cases in the United States have declined steadily since hitting a peak of 312,000 new cases a day on January 8th. Just 45,000 new cases were reported by the CDC on May 1st, down 86% from early January. Is COVID-19 on its way out? Zoe McLaren, Ph.D., is a health economist and an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Her recent piece in the New York Times makes the case that the end of the pandemic may be sooner than we think. It's titled, The Math That Explains the End of the Pandemic. Zoe McLaren, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You argue it's possible for COVID-19 numbers to drop quickly, even before we reach herd immunity, that point when so many people are immune to a disease that it's unlikely to spread. This would occur via a phrase you teach us, exponential decay. What is that?
So most people, I think, learned about exponential growth early in the pandemic. And the idea around exponential growth is that you could have a very low number of cases that could quickly skyrocket into a major outbreak. And so exponential decay is the opposite of that. So you could have a major outbreak that quite quickly could, the daily case numbers could drop down quite quickly. And so the idea around exponential decay is it tells us what the shape of the case curve is going to look like as the pandemic winds down. And that is that initially there'll be a steep drop in cases coming down from the peak, and then that that steepness will taper out. And so we'll end up with a much longer period with low numbers of cases. So the idea is that the worst of the pandemic can end fairly quickly when those case numbers drop down quite steeply, but that kind of after the end game of the pandemic may last quite a lot longer than people think, but it would be kind of a low number at low numbers of cases.
So there was a steep drop in cases from January to February. So are we in the midst of exponential decay?
So we've experienced exponential decay here in the U.S. since early January. We've seen cases come way down from the peak over the holidays. And around March, it kind of flattened out. So what drove a lot of the the decline since January was that people had traveled and socialized over the holidays, and then in January had decided that it was important to step up precautions. People were concerned about the rises in cases, and so that was a major driver. Then the vaccination programs really picked up. And so a lot of the continued decline was driven by vaccination programs. And then at some point in March, everybody realized that cases were coming down, the vaccination program was booming, and people started to let up a little bit on precautions and maybe were socializing more. And so that kind of slowed the decline a little bit and it kind of flattened out a little bit. But vaccinations continued. And so we've seen a kind of a continued decline from that point.
So the flattening out, the steep curve followed by a flatter curve, still downward, but not so steep, that's not inherent in the math. That's because of we loosened up too fast?
Exactly. So the math tells us about the kind of underlying dynamics. If we don't do anything, what's going to happen with transmission and case numbers? But of course, when we change behavior, the math that influences what the math ends up looking like in terms of our case numbers. So we think about exponential growth and exponential decay. There's a tipping point between them. And that tipping point has to do with the transmission rate. And the important thing to remember is that a lot of things drive the transmission rate. Vaccinations are going to be a major one. The more people that get vaccinated, the lower the transmission rate. And that is fantastic. But wearing masks, following social distancing guidelines, making sure that you avoid the risk of super spreader events, those types of things are also going to help lower the transmission rate. And so the shape of the curve is determined by that whole combination of factors. So we are vaccinating more and more, and that's great. But if people are also going to be easing up on social distancing, maybe not masking as carefully as they should, according to CDC guidelines when they're indoors, then we may see that that decline is going to slow, and we're going to have kind of a plateau in case numbers.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with UMBC health economist Zoe McLaren about how the pandemic will end. What could set the process back?
So the way to think about it is that we want to make sure that we keep cases on the decline. That means on the side of the tipping point that is exponential decay. It's good to start doing some easing up. The CDC has relaxed some masking guidelines and some social distancing guidelines. But the idea is that we don't want to relax too much relative to the rate of vaccination that we've achieved. So if we look at case numbers, the way to think about it is that if case numbers are starting to increase, then we want to be more careful. We want to step back with this, any socializing that we're doing. We want to step up our precautions. And as cases are declining, then we know we're moving in the right direction. And so as more and more people are vaccinated, that is going to help keep us in the realm of exponential decay. And the great thing about vaccination is it helps keep us there almost effortlessly. Once we're vaccinated, we are very unlikely to transmit the virus. And so we're really helping keep in exponential decay, keep cases heading downwards.
We've been talking about curves, sort of like long sweeping trends. Do you anticipate we will still see surges of infections here and there?
So the great thing about rising vaccination rates is that if we do have situations where there is a surge, the surge will be smaller. And that is because the more people that are vaccinated, the harder it is for the virus to spread. So we're not going to see those massive surges like we did earlier in the pandemic. However, one of our concerns is the fact that kids under 16 are not yet eligible to be vaccinated. We don't have an authorized or approved vaccination for them. And so we want to be really careful to watch the case numbers among kids, especially because those are the groups where we might actually see that exponential growth that we've learned about and are worried about. But among the older populations, adult populations, where we have pretty high rates of vaccination and those rates are also climbing, we'll expect that if there is a surge, we'll see far fewer cases among those older ages. And that is thanks to highly, highly effective and safe vaccines.
Some analysts say we should be prepared for COVID-19 to become an endemic disease like influenza. What do you think?
So I think that we don't know yet what's going to happen that far down the road. So right now we have a good idea about what's happening in terms of bringing case rates down with the vaccination rates that we have. but reaching that herd immunity threshold through high vaccination rates is still, it's unclear whether we'll be able to reach that. But I think the important thing to remember is that there is a massive payoff to everybody in this country to reaching that herd immunity threshold. That means that we will, if we can reach that point, that we will be effortlessly able to snuff the pandemic out from that point. And so it will take work to get there. There are people that are still hesitant about getting the vaccine, and they are going to require lots of support and encouragement and convincing and probably incentives, and also making the vaccine convenient and accessible for them. But I think it's important to remember that that is going to be very much worth it. That effort will be worth it. Because if we can reach that herd immunity threshold, that really changes everything for everyone. That is what really will bring the pandemic to an end.
Thank you for your hopeful analysis. Thanks.
My pleasure to be here.
Zoe McLaren, PhD, is a health economist and an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have a link to her piece published in the New York Times, The Math That Explains the End of the Pandemic. I'm Sheila Cass, glad you're with us on the record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks!